Commissioners, please take their seat. Heather, would you do the thing? Thank you. Everybody ready? No, I'll give them a... Yeah, I'd like to call the Planning Commission meeting to order. Good evening, everyone. Heather, would you lead us in the pledge?
Honored to. Please stand.
Put your hands over your heart and follow me. Ready? Begin.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you.
Roll call.
Roll call, please.
Commissioner Bentz.
Present.
Commissioner Colomarino.
Present.
Commissioner Schmidt.
Here.
Commissioner Ward.
Here.
Commissioner Sturdivant.
Here.
Vice Chairperson Moreno.
Here.
And Chairperson Jack.
Here.
All present.
Could I have a motion for approval of the agenda, please?
So moved.
Second.
Motion by Commissioner Moreno and second by Commissioner Benz. We have a vote, please.
Vice Chairperson Moreno?
Yes.
Commissioner Benz?
Yes.
Commissioner Colmarino?
Yes.
Commissioner Schmidt?
Yes.
Commissioner Ward?
Yes.
And Chairperson Jack?
Yes.
And Commissioner Sturdivant?
Yes.
Motion passes 7-0.
Thank you. At this time, we're open for public comment on any topic that is not on the agenda tonight and anything that the Planning Commission would have jurisdiction over. Please state your name and welcome.
Good evening. My name is Tim Haley, 9511 Los Palos, Atascadero. Current member of the Atascadero Veterans Memorial Committee, former member of that board. Also, I'm the current commandant of the Marine Corps League Detachment here in San Luis County, representing over 166 former Marines and associates. And I'm a proud member of the Central Coast Leatherneck Honor Guard, of which I wish to speak of specifically tonight. On that, what I want to start with is a recent press release. Saturday, the Atascadero Veterans Memorial was chosen by two recent Cal Poly graduates as the site to become U.S. Marine Corps officers in a ceremony in which the legacy of the Marine Corps was handed down to a newer generation. Joined by family, friends, and members of the Central Coast Leatherneck Honor Guard, Michael Gunther of Arlington, Virginia, and Blake Medeiros of Stockton, California, took the oath of a second lieutenant administered by Gunther's father, Colonel Christopher Gunther, USMC, retired. After the oath of office, Medeiros' mother and fiance pinned on his new insignia of rank, while Gunther's mother and sister did the honors for him. Then each received their first salute. Gunther from Tim Haley, Medeiros from his grandfather, Gene Medeiros. In a scene that would be difficult to match, the new lieutenants made a circuit of the monument and were congratulated by Marine members of the Leatherneck Honor Guard, standing before the plaque honoring their respective eras of service, from World War II to the War on Terror. The older Marines exchanged thanks, the traditional silver dollar, and handshakes with the new Marines. After both officers received gifts of vials of sand from Iwo Jima, Medeiros received an etched plaque of the flag raising on Mount Suribachi, and Gunther, his father's officer's sword with the Mameluke hilt. These young officers are scheduled to report in September to the basic school in Quantico, Virginia for training as rifle platoon commanders. Following this, Medeiros will train as a naval aviator. Gunther will decide his future specialty during basic school. And that was Saturday. What a great day it was. And what I want to stress is that the torch was essentially passed that day. We stood with members of the Honor Guard, specifically Carl Appel and Ben Belfly, who lives right out here on Homestead Road, who both served on Iwo Jima, who both were wounded on Iwo Jima. And they passed on to these new young officers the legacy of the Corps. In fact, I just was informed tonight that one of the people on your board panel here, her daughter, is just now going through the rigors of boot camp at Parris Island. So the Corps lives on. The Central Coast Leatherneck Honor Guard provides honors, military honors, at funerals for veterans throughout the Central Coast. We've done over, 650 funerals since its inception over 10 years ago. Jim Hawkins, our director, is here in the audience, and we're there on call every day of the week to provide those honors, and I just want to be sure that the word gets out, because it's often been said we're the best-kept secret on the Central Coast. So we're there for veterans, for the families, to provide them comfort in their time of need. So thank you for your time. Semper Fi.
Thank you very much, sir. Next item. Yes, ma'am. With that, I'll close public comment, and we'll move on to Planning Commission business. Anyone have any comments?
I'd like to ask a question about, I was watching a hearing recently at the City Council, and our city's participating in a stimulus program for solar panels and alternative energy packages. And I'd like to know more about it, so I'm wondering if sometime in the future that could be presented to us so we can inform others of the public of that program.
I'm sure as soon as the package is put together, the Economic Development Department or committee is working on that now. I sat through a meeting this morning where I gave a brief overview of what's been going on. So.
Okay.
Yeah, we can, and I think Warren, at the appropriate time, could we get some information on it?
Yes, staff's working on that. Callie's actually working on the RFP, so we can brief the commission on that at one of your next meetings.
That'd be great. Thank you very much. Anyone else? Okay, I have a comment, and it's relative to our job here. Our job is to conduct the city's business, and I know that we all enjoy a little humor now and then, but in the future, before anything gets presented to this commission by any member of the commission, please go through Warren and myself. No more surprises on video or personal presentations. I would appreciate it. With that, we do not have a consent calendar tonight. Yeah, we do?
We do, the minutes.
Oh, I'm sorry. I already approved them.
I move approval of the minutes.
Second.
Vice Chairperson Moreno moved that minutes be approved. Commissioner Benz was the second. Could I have roll call, please?
Vice Chairperson Moreno?
Yes.
Commissioner Benz?
Yes.
Commissioner Ward?
Yes.
Commissioner Colomarino?
Yes.
Commissioner Schmidt?
Yes.
Commissioner Sturdivant?
Abstain.
And Chairperson Jack?
Yes.
Motion passes 6-0 and one abstention.
Okay, the next item on the agenda is a staff report on amendment to zone change on West Front Road.
Chairperson Jack?
Yes.
As before on projects on this particular location, I will recuse myself because of the relationship of my home to the property.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for reminding me. Okay. Kelly, do you have something for us tonight?
Yes. Tonight we're going to say a presentation regarding the zone text change that's proposed. This is a zone text amendment, and it's regarding the West Front project. The project site borders the corner of Portola Road and West Front Road near Highway 101. The project was... It has multiple zoning districts in it. There's a multifamily site that you see here in orange, and then there's also a commercial site, which you see in red. And the part that we're actually talking about tonight is the business park portion of the project, and that's the highlighted site here in the center of the project. And this is a commercial retail site with a PD23 overlay, and the site is currently vacant. There has been preliminary grading down on the site, but no structures have been built. To give you a little bit of background about the project, it was originally approved in September of 2005, and it included 32 residences, a commercial retail site with three separate buildings for fast food, retail, and a restaurant. There's an existing Holiday Inn Express, which was part of the project and was constructed last year. And then the business park portion of the site is behind the Holiday Inn, adjacent to the residential. Tonight we are hearing a proposed code text change. A tenant is interested in occupying the buildings on the business park site for a laser tag and arcade business. Laser tag is considered indoor recreation services, and an arcade is categorized as amusement services under our Atascadero Municipal Code. The PD23 does not list recreation services, indoor rec services, or amusement services. And the allowed or conditional uses in the PD23. So because the PD has specific standards as to which uses are allowed, we need to amend the code in order to allow these uses on site. And that is what is being proposed tonight. This is the proposed code text change. And as in the resolution that was emailed out to you, it has items 20 and 21 of the allowed uses in the business park portion listed as amusement services and indoor recreation services. This is a site plan of the project design. This site plan was approved with the master plan of development in 2005, and it includes two separate buildings, totaling approximately 1,300 square feet. There were elevations approved with the original master plan of development, and those are proposed to be constructed as originally approved. The original parking ratio on the project was approximately one per 400 square feet of space. Business park uses, the ones that were identified in the allowed and conditional uses, tend to be a lower intensity uses. For example, a warehouse use would be one per 500 square feet, one space required per 500 square feet of floor area. There is additional parking that can be provided in front of the roll-up doors. The project was originally approved for warehouse roll-up doors, and those can be eliminated with additional parking in place of those. And that would raise the parking ratio to one per 300 square feet. Since amusement services are classified in our code as a higher intensity use with required one space per 100 square feet of floor area, it requires an exception for the PD23 to allow the parking to go in as originally approved with the master plan. So there are no changes proposed to the master plan. What the change is that you see here in blue at the bottom is that a special exception would be included in here saying that the parking would be installed per the master plan, and for indoor recreation and amusement services, they shall provide no less than one space per 300 square feet of floor area, which can be done with the parking in lieu of those roll-up doors. The project is consistent with the original mitigated negative declaration for the project. These are the findings as shown in your staff report and the resolution, and it does include one additional finding in addition to the standard zone text change findings. And this fourth finding is required for the parking reduction, and this is something, a standard finding that the Planning Commission needs to make in order to find that the parking is fine as proposed, and that just says that the type of design and improvements warrant the reduced parking. Staff is recommending that the Planning Commission approve the project as proposed. These are the alternatives as listed in your staff report, and staff and the applicant are here if you have questions.
Thank you. Any questions of staff? Commissioner Sturdivant?
Yes, I was wondering on that picture on the right-hand, upper right-hand side, it says shared driveway, and that's for the business portion. Where does that tie in with the lower, the overall plan there? Where does that drive tie in?
This driveway that you see in the top corner is basically comes right from West Front Road right here on the side of the Holiday Inn. So the driveway to get to the business park portion is actually a shared driveway on the neighboring site, and that's in an easement. And you can sort of see a little bit of a driveway entrance here at the corner, and that's this driveway here. Okay. So the buildings are actually against the back of the site and against the residential.
Thank you.
Anyone else? Vice Chairman Moreno?
So that shared driveway would be with the hotel or with the health club and the lumber?
It would be shared with the health club and the lumber supply.
And is there any reason why those, the amusement services and indoor recreation weren't originally included in the PD-23? Is there any specific reason why?
It wasn't discussed with the original project. It was proposed as a business park, and those aren't typically business park uses. But the site is zoned commercial retail, so they could be provided within that area if the PD-23 text was changed.
Okay. And it possibly would it not have been included because of the parking issue?
I think that the original intention of the site was for more of a business park use. So this is just a new type of use for the site that wasn't considered before.
All right, thank you.
Commissioner Colomarino?
Maybe I'm the only one who doesn't know what a laser tag center is, but maybe you'd enlighten me on that. What exactly is that?
The tenant is actually here in the audience, and he can probably explain a little bit better than I can. But technically, under our code, it's a type of indoor recreation, so sort of like it's classified like ice skating or that sort of use. So it's an activity in indoors.
It's a game of tag. I know what tag is from the old days. Is this a form of it?
Excuse me, Commissioner. Commissioner Ward looked it up and has a description of it, and maybe if you would enlighten all of us, Commissioner Ward, I appreciate it.
Not often I get an opportunity to enlighten my colleague here, but I actually Googled it because I had the same question. Fundamentally, it's a very, very interesting modern type of game. It's been around for a few years. There are groups all over the world. They have conventions. But think of it like a paintball game without paintballs, and as lasers and a little electronic beam similar to your remote control for a TV. There's an elaborate system of computers that record the scores. And you have people that get absolutely hooked on it. There's all sorts of games. There's a very elaborate electronic setup. It's not a cheap thing. And the more I looked at it, I thought this is a marvelous facility for the youth in this community in view of the fact that we don't have a movie theater. And there are these facilities, but they're outside of the community. And this does not appear to be the type of community.
Thank you, Commissioner Ward. Commissioner Ward, thank you very much.
Okay. As I said, I looked it up and there's a lot of information on it.
No, appreciate it. Any other questions? Vice Chairperson Moreno?
At the risk of sounding geeky, I played back in the early years of college, so if anyone has any questions, feel free to ask me. I even had a call sign.
Commissioner Calamarino.
And then the arcade business, I take it, is just like an arcade for pinball machines and things like that? Is that what we're talking about?
That's correct.
Okay. Now, then, in terms of the parking ratio requirements, the laser tag operation, you think, would be a low parking intensity use? Is that what your assumption is?
Our code does not specify for indoor recreation. The closest that we could think of would be the amusement services, which is also being requested on the site. So that parking is listed as a higher intensity use per our code, but there's also some other factors to consider on this. It's a larger building. It's not going to be one of, I think the code is probably written for smaller arcades where you get a lot of people in a small space using all of the pinball machines and things like that. With laser tag, it tends to be more, I think, families or birthday parties, things like that, where you get larger groups coming together in one car. So we're not expecting it to be as such a high intensity use.
So if we took a continuum, I think you indicate in the staff report the high intensity is one parking space per 100 square feet, and then the lowest intensity would be one parking space for 500 square feet. Is that right? And then you're placing this sort of right in the middle here at 300 square feet. Is that? Space per 300 square feet?
That's correct. If I could just jump in real quick. Typically, our industrial, lower intensity uses, the parking ratios, rule of thumb is kind of 1 to 400, 1 to 500 ratio. 1 to 300, that's our typical retail commercial number. So our big shopping centers like Home Depot, Bonds, typically those were built about those ratios. So 1 to 300 seems like it generally works in retail settings. And as Callie mentioned, you know, these are fairly large buildings, especially a laser tag. People will be fairly spread out. It won't be intensive like everybody's standing next to pinball machines. We thought 1 to 300, our typical retail number, would be very appropriate for this use.
Do you have any idea why the amusement services was categorized as a higher intensity use than one, which would put it in the 1 to 100 bracket?
I think just because historically they tended to be like the pinball arcades that were in very small buildings with a lot of pinball machines. So if you had like a 300 square foot building with 20 machines in it, you might need 5 or 6 spaces, and then it would work out to that ratio. But it doesn't apply when you get up to 15,000 square feet.
Thanks.
Thank you. Commissioner Sturdivant?
Yeah, one more question. I'm assuming both of these buildings are being used for this, one for laser tag, one for amusement. Is that how it's working?
That's correct. I think that the plan is to put laser tag in one building and then the arcade in the other.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions? Seeing none, I ask the applicant to come to the lectern and enlighten us some more.
Good evening, Chair People.
Good evening.
I'm Richard Shannon, one of the partners of West Front Village LLC. We've been here before doing little amendments. And just real quick, we did originally design this center as a business park. And those were, as you can see on the property map there, those were 9 individual lots. And the buildings were going to be built as 2 buildings, but 9 units. And then each unit would be sold off individually as individual small light industrial startup commercial type spaces. And so that was the original intent. The market has gone south completely on that. And our current tenant came along. And a couple things you need to be aware of. We've actually taken this project was previously taken completely through the building department. So all of our construction documents have already been generated and approved by the city. And so one of the big issues with us is right now is one of the big issues we're fighting is cost of the building and, of course, financing. But we're working on both of those. And one of the things that we can do to help save costs is use our existing plans, which are it's a very nice, attractive looking building. It's an overkill for a laser tag building. But we by using the existing plans and using the existing parking layout, we can save substantially on our fees and help us with getting him in here. The tenant came along to us a couple months ago, and we sat down and said, wow, this is actually a great use for this site. You have a hotel in front, which would be handy for parents to send their kids over and play. We're going to have a series of restaurants and food services along the frontage road, and we have a gym already. All the businesses would basically help feed into the entertainment business, and the entertainment business would help feed into them. So this is a family entertainment business where we feel like the parking is plenty adequate for what we've got proposed there. And we're in favor of staff's report, and we would like to move forward as soon as possible. The two big things we're working on right now are trying to get our construction costs down to a manageable level, which we are working diligently on, and finishing up our financing. We seem to be moving forward with both of those. And barring any surprises, we could be under construction on this building sometime in October or so. So I'm here. Eric, the tenant, is here. He can explain to you his business a little better than I can. But I have played laser tag before, about 15 years ago in Thousand Oaks, and the building is still there and operating in the same location. So it seems to be it's been around for a while, and it's, like you said, it's paintball. It's an indoor paintball version of game. It's very fun. The teenagers love it. My kids have told me, get this built. We'll love it. So we're here to answer any questions you have. Okay?
Thank you, Mr. Shannon. Let me see if any of the commissioners have any questions. None?
Okay, I'll let Eric come up and tell you about his business real quick.
Thank you very much.
Good evening, Chairperson. Commissioners, my name is Eric Estelle. I'm a lifelong resident of the area. I was impressed by the definition of the laser tag. I would be happy to answer any questions to the best of my ability.
Are there any questions at this point? Commissioner Calamarino, do you have any more?
I know what tag is, and I guess the idea is people run around and they fire a laser at each other as a way of tagging them? Is that the idea?
As the commissioner explained, it's not so much a laser. It is a infrared device. It does look futuristic, the type of gun that is used. There's no running involved. Quick, rapid movement is allowed, but no running due to liability. I played several times, and it's a great workout without the running. But it's a sensor that you wear on your body, and somebody else tags you with an infrared beam that you won't even see. So there's no inherent dangers of laser. And it's just all run off of a infrared system.
How do you get the workout if you don't run?
You walk rapidly. Fast, and it actually burns more calories than jogging.
And will there be age limitations on participating? Or nobody over a certain age can do it?
Oh, no, no. As long as you're big enough to wear the equipment, and, well, my mom, who just turned 70, well, I won't tell you how old, but she went down and played in Santa Maria with me recently as I was investigating this whole idea. So there's no age limitations.
Is it played in teams or individually?
It has many variations depending upon the game. The sport has grown to include where there are actually international teams that travel around the world and compete. It would be my desire, hopefully, in several years, that our facility would become known and could host some tournaments.
Maybe it'll be a planning commission team.
I hope to see you all there on grand opening.
Oh, Commissioner Sturdivant?
Oh, I just had one question. How long does a game last? Is it a timed? I would assume it's a timed.
It's generated. It's the computer will run it. Typically, from the time you get your briefing, you get your equipment on, and you play the game, and then take the equipment off and come back into the air building, that's close to half an hour.
Oh, okay.
20 minutes to half an hour. So the actual game would, you're getting shot at and shooting mm-hmm. your friends, 15, 20 minutes.
Oh, good. I'd give our kids something to do. That's good.
Absolutely.
Excellent.
And then it's always fun to, well, you didn't do so well that game. You come back mm-hmm. and get them next time.
Good. Thank you.
Are there any other commissioners? Commissioner Ward?
Just a quick question. I'm sort of curious. How do you price this for kids going there?
Well, I, as I've explained to everybody, I'm, you know, I do have altruistic intentions, but of course I have to make a profit to stay in business to provide the service. Typically, one game average will run about $5. And the okay. national average from my investigations are running $7 to $8 per game. I would like to keep it somewhere around the $5 range.
Good. Any other questions? Seeing none. Thank you, Mr. Estella.
Thank you.
What I'd like to do then is open it to anyone from the public that would like to comment on the issue.
Hi, I am Ann Hatch with the Atascadero Parks and Rec and live in 12505 Atascadero, Santa Ana Road. It sounds like a wonderful business opportunity. I just had a couple of questions, actually four. One, what hours do you expect your highest patronage? One, so we can kind of guesstimate when we think that the parking lot might be more impacted one time more than another. I'm really hoping that a business like this would be very successful. Looking at the diagram, am I accurate in my seeing? It looks like there's 14 parking spaces. Is that correct?
42, I think.
42. Oh, that's considerably more than what I could see from that insert there at the top. So okay, so parking doesn't seem to be an issue. I guess my other question was. Since this would back up to a housing area, is there going to be any risk of any sort of a noise problem? Because it's indoors, you wouldn't think so, although I've had teenage kids too. So I didn't know. I mean, as I said, I'm very much for a business like this being very successful. I'm just looking to be sure that we're matching a housing area and a business up well. That's all.
Okay. Thank you. We'll take all the comment, and we'll answer the questions at one time.
I'm sorry?
I said we'll take all the comment from anyone wishing to speak, and then we'll answer the questions at the conclusion of the comments.
Okay. Amar Sohi. I'm the general manager of the Holiday Inn Express and Suites. And I'm pretty similar to the previous comments. I have the same questions about noise because we're the hotel right next door, so that might affect the hotel guests as well. And the other question was hours of operation, not necessarily just when the peak attendance is going to be, but from opening to closing, what are those hours of operation? Because we were expecting a business park where the hours would be closing at 5 p.m., and depending on how late that this is open, it may pose a problem, it may not, but that's primarily one of our biggest concerns. And then in following that, what is going to be the target customer base? Is it going to be teenagers? Because if they're closing at, say, 9-10 o'clock, and you have teenagers from Paso Robles High School, Atascadero High School, all meeting up and playing laser tag and whatnot, what time will they be departing the facilities? Would there be conflict or whatever? Would there be noise issues and car issues there as well? So primarily it's that noise and hours of operation. As far as parking, I'm relieved to see that's going to be separate parking and that it wouldn't be shared parking with the business center. And that's it.
Very good. Thank you, sir. Anyone else?
My name is Ron Holland. I'm from San Luis Obispo, and I'm an owner in the Holiday Inn Hotel and Suites. We originally came into this hotel under the thinking that we would have a business park behind there. And obviously, there's some concern about noise and maybe kids hanging out, creating more noise in the evening. I don't, the hours of operation are very important to me, as to our clients at the hotel. This is not something that we bought into when we put the hotel, or when we bought into the hotel and built it. Not that it's bad. That's not what we're saying. Not what I'm saying. I'm concerned about the hours of operation and that we don't have a lot of teenagers hanging out there after hours. I don't want it to become a hangout because it will severely affect the hotel. Thank you.
Very good, Mr. Allen. Thank you. Anyone else? Seeing none. Maybe I could have Mr. Stella. Pardon? Would you approach the lectern, please? Maybe you're the person to most directly be able to supply the answers to some of these questions, particularly the noise and the hours of operation and that.
Absolutely.
Your target base.
And they're valid concerns, and I appreciate that. And without offering a 100% guarantee, a little bit of my background, I'm a retired Paso Robles police officer. And my concern, as well as yours, is not to turn this into a hangout. My clientele, I envision, are mostly family and teenagers, but I want them coming to my business to enjoy themselves, not to stay outside creating a social gathering point with the associated things that can happen from that. I will be very aware of what's going on in and around these buildings because it is will be part of my livelihood. And with that type of activity going on, my family business will then no longer be attractive to my clients. So I will not tolerate any outside activity in and around the facilities, not only for my concern for my neighbors, but concern for my livelihood.
Okay. What about the hours of operation?
Hours of operation, typically Fridays and Saturday nights. I didn't bring my business plan, but I believe I had foreseen about midnight. And again, with that going on, the activities are inside the facility, not outside the facility.
Okay. So essentially, you know, the noise would just be other vehicles coming and going.
Yes, sir. And basically fronting Highway 101, a couple of vehicles slowly leaving the parking lot or coming into it. Shouldn't be a great concern.
And then can I assume from your comment that your target base would be the teenagers and young adults?
It's the whole family.
Okay.
I would be happy to have the whole family there. I'm hopefully building out the facility for families to hold birthday parties for young children and teenagers in there. And as I was asked earlier, there's no limit on the age that people can come and play.
Okay. Commissioner Benz?
I have a question for Richard Shannon.
Sure.
What about the hours of operation on the restaurants and that at that site?
I don't believe there's any restrictions on the hours of operation
right.
on the restaurants.
So there'd be cars coming and going at the restaurants and the fast food?
Yes.
And cars coming and going at all hours of the day and night at the hotel?
I would assume so, yeah. And then the gym, I don't know what the hours of operation are on the gym. I think it's open until 10 or 11 o'clock also.
And what is the typical noise level within the enclosed building for the a dB, a decibel rating within your building with the equipment that you use?
I have no idea, but these are block buildings.
Mm-hmm.
So they are block constructed buildings. There shouldn't be any noise really going outside of those buildings other than the cars coming in and out, people going in and out of the cars. Now, all the activities designed inside, and the laser tag building is the one closest to the hotel, which will have groups of about 30 to 35 people at a time inside the building, and then they'll go out. And then the arcade and other buildings, the arcade and food service and stuff would be in the other building. And again, on the back of the buildings are solid block walls designed to back up to the residential. And in fact, the building A is a solid block wall across the back, plus there's a block wall behind the solid block wall. So there should be plenty of buffering, I think, on that area.
Okay, thank you very much.
I think we could be a good neighbor for everybody.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Shannon. Mr. Holland, was there something you wanted to contribute?
There is. I'm okay to speak now.
Go ahead, please.
Looking at the plot map there, I can't determine exactly where things are or how sound walls are created. Is there a better map? Is there a better layout that I can see there that tells me what's going on?
Callie?
This is basically flipped. So the driveway entrance is right here, and then you would have these two buildings up against the back property line. And
did you say these two or these?
This building, buildings A and B. Building A would be here against the residential vertical, and then building B would be here horizontal against the back property line.
And the rest in parking?
That's correct.
And why do we not have that diagram on the screen tonight?
This is the site plan submitted by the applicant, part of the building permits.
Yes.
So it's just not oriented the same to the
Well, I don't
plan.
See the two buildings. I see 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 lots across one part, and then I see 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 lots across another part. I do not see where the buildings are located.
This is the approved master plan of development, so they just aren't facing the same direction.
Right. But in coming before us tonight and to look at this project, we're not seeing what they're proposing.
Well, we can just rotate that upper right corner.
Well, that would be good.
And then there we go.
Okay, so that is the configuration on the site behind the hotel, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Thank you. And the area in between the two buildings is all parking?
Yes. There's some parking here near the entrance, parking in the center, and then parking in front of each building.
Okay. And on the building that's on your lower right, is the sound wall on that right side against the hotel is what?
There's no sound wall here between the hotel and the business park.
Okay, I would suggest that might be an important feature. The applicant is suggesting that he would be open till midnight on Saturday, Friday and Saturday, which is obviously a big night for the hotel.
Mr. Holland, your time is up, sir.
Okay, you've heard my...
Yes, thank you. And we've already... Is there something that you wanted to add to this, sir?
A separate question, yeah. Will they be serving alcohol at this venue, number one? And then number two, in Mr. Bent's comments, the Jack in the Box is on the far side of the lot, and there's not one restaurant in Atascadero that's open till midnight on the weekends. So that's a big difference, yeah.
Okay, what about the Mr. Shannon or Mr. Estrella? Will there be alcohol?
No, sir.
Thank you. Okay, seeing we've had plenty of conversation, I'll close the public comment and bring it back to the commission for some deliberation. Any questions that anyone has of staff or Commissioner Sturdivant?
Callie, between the right behind the Holiday Inn Express and this complex, is there a wall behind the Holiday Inn Express? I thought there was a stone wall or a brick wall of some sort.
Not directly behind the Holiday Inn. This is there's a retaining wall back there, but not a sound wall.
Okay, thank you.
Anyone else? I think we got all the questions. Does anyone want to make a motion?
Mr. Chairman, I move that the Planning Commission adopt resolution PC 2009-0024, recommending that the City Council introduce an ordinance for first reading by title only to approve an amendment to zone text change 2003-0058 to add indoor recreation services and amusement services to the allowed uses in the business park portion of the PD 23 with special parking requirements based on findings.
I second it.
Motion by Commissioner Benz, second by Commissioner Ward. Any discussion? Seeing none, we get a roll call, please. Mm-hmm.
Commissioner Benz?
Yes.
Commissioner Ward?
Yes.
Commissioner Colmarino?
Yes.
Commissioner Sturdivant?
Yes.
Vice Chairperson Moreno?
Yes.
Chairperson Jack?
Yes.
Motion passes 6-0.
With that, okay, the next item is, are there any commissioner comments or reports? Seeing none, director's report.
Yes, thank you. We're going to just a little update on tonight's meeting. We're going to adjourn after my report here, and we'll reconvene at 7 o'clock for our joint session with the City Council. We're going to reset everybody's seating. We're going to put the council in the center, and we'll put the commission off to the wings. In terms of our meeting schedule, keep in mind we have a fifth Tuesday this month, so there's 3 weeks before your next meeting. Your next meeting is scheduled for, I believe... Let me find out. I think it's June or July 7th. Yes, July 7th. Right now, we don't have any agenda items. It's possible we might be canceling that meeting. If we do cancel it, we'll get a notification out probably later next week on that. Also, this week, we do have the boutique events study session on Thursday night. It'll be... across the hall in room 4. I recall that I think a couple of the commissioners were interested in attending. We aren't noticing this is a Brown Act meeting, so we recommended that we limit our attendance to just 3 commissioners to that meeting. And with that, that'll conclude my report.
Thank you very much. And the 3 commissioners are Commissioner Ward, Commissioner Benz, and Commissioner Schmidt. Thank you very much. We'll adjourn the meeting.
I'd like to call the joint meeting of the Planning Commission and City Council to order. Could we have roll call first, please?
Councilmember Clay?
Yes.
Councilmember Kelly?
Here.
Mayor Pro Tem Fonzie?
Here.
We have Councilmember O'Malley, who's absent, and Mayor Bayrou, who's absent. Commissioner Bentz?
Present.
Commissioner Colomarino?
Present.
Commissioner Schmidt?
Here.
Commissioner Ward?
Here.
Commissioner Sturtevant?
Here.
Vice Chairperson Moreno?
Here.
And Chairperson Jack?
Here.
10 present, 2 absent.
Thank you, Annette. Jerry Clay, would you lead us in the pledge to the flag, please?
Please rise. Ready to begin. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. And introductions first. Warren, would you like to lead off with that and introduce?
Yes. Thank you, Vice Mayor, members of the Council, and members of the Commission. Thank you very much for attending tonight. Tonight what we're doing is this is a joint session. This is a workshop, and this is basically our kickoff process to our housing element update. We're required by the state to update our housing element numbers on a periodic basis. We have a new allocation that's come down through the state and then through SLOCOG. We are under a requirement to have these our new elements submitted to the state in late August, so we're working toward that date. I'd like to introduce our consultants who are going to be doing the preparation of our housing element for us, Lisa Wise of Lisa Wise Consulting, and then she's accompanied by Tyler Bridges. So I'm going to turn it over to Lisa. She's got a presentation, a lot of information. This is a workshop, so we're going to try to run a little less formally. So if you have questions, feel free to ask the questions as they come up. We're thinking that we'll provide an opportunity for the public to make comments at the end of the presentation, but obviously it's at the council's discretion if you want to introduce anything or, you know, throw us a change up. We're real flexible. So with that, I'll introduce Lisa.
Thank you.
Thank you, Warren. My name is Lisa Wise. We are based in San Luis Obispo, a local firm doing planning around the state. We're doing several housing element updates, and we recently kicked off the housing element with staff here at the city. So this is a kickoff meeting. We have some basic information on state requirements and some preliminary data we like to present, but it's really the chance for the Planning Commission and Council to kind of weigh in and let us know what's important as we kind of focus our research and establish programs for the housing element update. This is just an overview of the presentation. I won't spend too much time on this. So we'll look at state requirements. We have some preliminary information on community demographics. We'll look at the fair share, regional housing needs allocation, sometimes referred to as RENA. I have a couple slides on housing affordability and actually how that's changed over time given the current market conditions. We did have stakeholder interviews last week, so I have a little bit of information on that and some of the preliminary information we've got from the community. And then we'll talk about the schedule because of the state timeline, we are under a tight schedule in some ways to keep this moving forward. It is a lot of information, though, so as Warren said, since we have a fairly small crowd, we'll entertain questions as we move forward. So this is an opportunity, I think, for the city to look at and inventory the resources and opportunities to plan for housing. It's a key component of the community. Most of the city is residential development. It's one of the 7 elements of the general plan, although unlike the other elements, it's heavily regulated by the state and it's required to be certified by the state. One of the new things that's come about in the last year or two is that it's tied more and more to funding, that you have to have a certified housing element to apply for funding, either because you get additional points for funding or because you have to be certified to apply for that program or grant at all. For instance, you get points for the BEGIN program, you get points for home funding, you get points for some CDBG funding. You have to be certified to apply for CDBG over-the-counter economic grants. So there's lots of funding the state's tying to having your housing element certified. These are the state requirements. I'll run through these sort of quickly. This is the kickoff of the public participation component, which is a key component of the housing element update. We'll also look at the previous element and was it effective. We're working with staff right now to conduct the housing needs assessment. This is a big data collection phase where we look at demographics, population, housing affordability, tenure, units, units at risk, special needs groups, those kind of factors that play into housing decisions. We also evaluate local resources and constraints. Local resources include availability of vacant and underutilized land, and in addition, the redevelopment agency funding and programs. In terms of constraints, we look at governmental and non-governmental constraints. Non-governmental constraints are items like the cost of land, the cost of construction, what's going on with financing right now. We know there's not a lot of financing available out there. Governmental constraints are things we have more control over, fees, general plan designations, zonings, processes, those type of issues. And then we'll draft goals, policies, and programs and put together a five-year, or actually in this case, I think it's a seven-year implementation program. There has been an onslaught of new legislation, and I don't really see the pendulum swinging in terms of this. These are some of the new legislation that we need to be aware of. State density bonus law has changed. It's now on a sliding scale from 20 to 35% based on affordability thresholds. There's also anti-NIMBY legislation recently adopted, which makes it more difficult to deny affordable housing project unless your housing element is certified and that site has not been identified for higher density housing. No net residential capacity law, so once you have your higher density sites identified for your RENA allocation, you can't downzone them unless you can make certain findings. You are in compliance with the second unit law, so I won't go into that. I'm going to talk about the sites inventory in a couple minutes.
Why not go into that?
The second unit?
Right.
Well, because the city's already complied with the legislation, but that's the state legislation that made application for second units ministerial.
Well, thank you. That's what I wanted to know.
You're welcome.
Not to interrupt, but please take your questions to the chair, else we will have chaos with this many people. Thank you, Jerry.
Thank you. The next on the list is this unaccommodated housing needs, which means we need to plan for our previous RENA, and I have a slide showing that too. And then SB2 is a recent legislation looking at emergency shelters and transitional housing that we need to find a zone or an overlay zone to provide for at least one emergency shelter. The homeless report that Cal Poly and EOC is producing won't be out till the end of the summer, but the preliminary numbers show about 3,800 homeless folks in the county, and almost 300 of those in the city of Atascadero, with a large chunk of those actually being children, about 70 to 75 children they anticipate being homeless. So you're probably familiar with some of these next few slides, so I'll go through them relatively quickly. This shows population growth in Atascadero. Slide's a little bit hard to see, but most of the demographics in the city have tracked pretty closely with the county overall. This shows growth from 1990 to 2000 and then 2008, where the city had a population of about 28,600.
Excuse me, Ms. Weiss, we have a question for you.
Yeah, mm-hmm. On the anti-NIMBY law, could you explain that a little bit, what's going on there?
Sure. Under the anti-NIMBY legislation that the state adopted, you cannot deny an affordable housing project unless you can make certain findings. One of them being your housing element is in compliance and your RENA is accomplished. So if you've met all your RENA allocation, then you could deny the project. The project would have a specific adverse effect. It doesn't comply with other state or federal regulation. The easiest one, I think, for cities to meet is that your housing element was in compliance and that site was not identified for higher density housing. That would be a finding you could make to deny an affordable housing project if they're brought forward. Otherwise, if you cannot make these findings, if somebody comes into your town, it's more difficult to deny the project.
Could you address the RMF 16 versus RMF 20, the 20 units per acre?
Yeah, I have a slide on this in a minute, but the...
Okay, well, that's fine if you got to come.
Okay.
Is there any other questions while we've got her? Okay, go ahead.
Thank you. Moving on to these demographic slides, this shows housing unit growth. since the 1990 census. Again, the city has tracked pretty closely to the county overall, about 11% growth from 1990 to 2000, jumping up to about 11,000 units as of 2008. Most of these are single-family detached, as most of us are aware. This is the age distribution for the city as of the 2000 census. Mostly families, again, median age in the city is about 38, which is close to the county. The county is at about 37. The senior households, while not very large, census statistics show that about 50% of senior households live at the very low or low income
level. Another question for you, ma'am.
Would that possibly have changed quite a bit in the last 8 years due to the cost of living on the Central Coast and the retirees coming to the area?
Yeah, I mean, one of the unfortunate things, and they don't plan this with the census, but we are dealing with the census data to a large extent because there's not more recent data available. Demographics have changed, the market's changed, the economy's changed. It's hard to reflect that, I think, in our analysis. So to the extent that the Planning Commission or Council has more information that we need to take into account, I definitely think that's a possibility that the demographics have changed. This is 10 years old. So everybody would have moved up.
Thank you.
Thank you. The next slide's on the racial makeup and ethnicity of the city, mostly white, about 11% Hispanic. That is, the Hispanic numbers are slightly below the county. The county overall is about 18% Hispanic. These next few slides get into ARENA, Regional Housing Needs Allocation, sometimes called Fair Share. So what you're seeing here is a lot of information. As you know, the allocation starts at the state level by HCD. They project population needs. It's then turned into households based on persons per household. That's allocated to the COGS, in our case the SLOCOG, and then SLOCOG divvies that up between the unincorporated county and all the cities in the county. The RENA for the 2007-2014 period for the county overall was 4,885 units. This slide, is showing the RENA from the previous period, which is the 2001-2006 period where the city had 1,713 units. And it's also showing the RENA for the current period, 2007-2014, where the city has 462 units in that center column. And then it totals them. As I think most of you are aware, the RENA is also broken up by income category, very low, moderate, and above moderate, for further analysis. So because of recent legislation, we need to look at the previous RENA and the current RENA, which is 762 very low and low income units. What we are working on now with staff is looking at how much construction has happened since 2001, because we can take that into account so we can reduce our number by activity that's happened. And then we're also working on a vacant land analysis to see how we can meet the fair share. And I have a slide on that in a minute. There has been almost 100 very low, low and moderate units built since 2000, though, 95, I think, to be exact. So to meet the RENA, we are doing a site inventory and analysis, looking at adequate sites to accommodate the fair share numbers. The state wants us to provide zoning for a variety of housing types, single family and multifamily. This requires us to do a detailed analysis of sites, looking at a general plan, zoning, acres, units per acres, looking at capacity calculations then. Usually we look at an 80% capacity calculation because we don't get full build out. And also taking into environmental and infrastructure constraints for those particular parcels. It looks like typically the city builds out at a higher in their higher density zones at about 14 to 19 dwelling units per acre. This is the vacant land inventory from the previous housing element. We are working on updating this. As you can see from this slide, most of this is in low density. Here, the low-density residential category, some in the medium and high-density residential categories of almost 1,100. ARENA, as we just talked about, is 2,175 units. Based on some recent numbers we put together with staff, it looks like the city can accommodate almost 600 medium and high density units. So we're in the process of updating this and pulling it together for the fair share numbers. Moving on to affordability, this slide shows by income level what a family of four would earn based on 2009 income produced by the state HCD. So a very low-income household of four, according to state thresholds, would earn $35,400. Low-income household, $56,650. Moderate income household could earn up to $84,950. And then what we did was to show what the rents those households could afford are, and then how much a house they could afford. So rents range from almost $900 for a very low-income household to about $2,100 for a moderate-income household. And then on the ownership, based on 6% interest rate, 30-year loan, 10% down, which I know the financing has changed a lot, they could afford about $100,000 to almost $300,000. I have another slide, but that shows that the moderate-income households can almost get into, or pretty much get into market-rate housing now. Just another thing I wanted to point out here, too, when you're thinking about a very low-income household, that's a retail or service worker generally. Lower-income households could be teachers, nurses, government workers, and then when you move up to moderate, you get into pharmaceutical, more professional kind of jobs, and I have a slide that shows some of that information next. These are some salary ranges we pulled together recently, looking at just the types of positions and the estimated salary ranges, annual salary ranges for those positions, to give you an idea of who falls into these different categories. This shows home prices going back to 2002. So pretty much, I think, 2000, prices jumped up pretty significantly to peak in 2006. At the peak in 2006, prices in the city were about $450,000. That's these numbers here. The city is in the blue on the left. The county overall is in orange on the right, so it's tracking how the city has stacked up against the county overall. Most cities around the state peaked in 2006, and then since then, prices have fallen really around the country. Most recent data from the California Association of Realtors for the first quarter of 2009 show the city to be at about $300,000, $297,000. The county overall is $365,000. So moderate income households can start to get into market rate housing for home ownership. As I mentioned earlier, we did have stakeholder interviews about a week ago. On Tuesday, we met with several folks here at City Hall, a few members from the business community and local nonprofits. 30-minute one-on-one interviews. We had a lot of time to kind of talk about the housing issues and some of the things these organizations were concerned about. This summarizes the outcome of those interviews. A couple of things I mentioned, though, that were processes and procedures were working at the city, including the public outreach process. They were really complimentary in that regard. Another thing we heard often, though, was the need to preserve the rural character. At the same time, and it's not on this slide, but there was an interest in protecting the downtown, too, or making the downtown more vibrant. So there's I think it's common now in cities to kind of want an active downtown that has character and preserve the fringes. And that's some of the stuff we heard in the interviews. Another thing that we heard was just to understand the needs of disabled, homeless, and seniors. Section 8 vouchers in the county. The county gets 1,825 vouchers. Section 8 vouchers, there's 900 people on the waiting list. There's 278 of those vouchers are in the city, and there's over 100 people waiting in Atascadero for vouchers. So while affordability has gotten a little bit better, we still have real housing needs.
Question for you, ma'am.
That came up in the interview.
On the Section 8 vouchers, I think you said there was 800 or 900 people on the waiting list. Is that because the housing units are not available, or is that just the allotment that the government gives to the city or the county?
That's the allotment. We have a 1,825 allotment. And you pretty much can't get on the list unless somebody moves away or passes away. Another thing, just thinking about the regulations and the RENA numbers that came up in the interviews, was the need to evaluate and consider overlays for affordable housing, so that if there was areas that the city wanted to target for higher density affordable housing, instead of doing a blanket, it could go anywhere. That might be an option. Maybe even increasing the density in those overlays over and above what the base zone is, and considering an overlay for the homeless shelter requirements. More flexible development standards come up often. One of the things that came up in the interviews with the parking standards, in particular, one of the comments we heard was about downtown parking. While you can do shared parking downtown for commercial, it's more difficult for residential. That was one of the comments we heard on some of the development standards, although, honestly, we didn't hear a lot of input on the development standards and ways to improve those. Everybody thought that the process was working fairly well. Even though the city, we know, doesn't have control over this, there was comments on the fees for water meters and the fact that a second unit needs a water meter, too, came up, so we thought it was worth mentioning. Going back to second units, some folks thought the requirements or size limits on second units was a bit restrictive, even though it's fairly large. I think by county standards, that's one of the items we heard during the interviews. And then this last slide, we have a follow-up slide on, but just thinking about the redevelopment agency opportunities and funds there, and kind of how we want to focus that. Some of the things we heard in the interviews was to focus on rental housing, over-ownership housing, maybe looking at site acquisitions or purchasing sites or buying down property values, and then really leveraging the funds to get the maximum benefit. This slide goes into the redevelopment agency a little bit, because we are required by the housing element to look at the redevelopment agency, set aside funds, a low mod income housing fund, what the fund is, what the projections are over the planning period, and if there's any established programs the city has. So I think some of the things for the Planning Commission and Council to consider tonight are just facilitating the development of affordable housing with those funds, establishing priorities, and utilizing the fund efficiently, and thinking, starting to think about constructive programs we can include in the housing element. This is my last slide. It's an overview of the timeline and where we are. We're working with staff to get a public review draft out next month in July. After that, we'll have follow-up meetings with the Planning Commission or Council. Tentatively, we'd like to come to the City Council, on August 11th, depending on the agenda. After that, we'll send it to the state. They have a 60-day review period. It'll come back to us with comments. We'll work with the Planning Commission staff, Planning Commission, and Council to address the comments. And then it'll go back to state after adoption, and they have another 90-day review period. And that concludes my presentation.
Do we have any questions? Council Member Clay?
In regards to the second unit, and maybe Warren could help me on this, but is our maximum now 800 square feet, Warren? Or?
I believe it depends on the size of the lot. The smaller lots, it's limited to 800 square feet, and on the larger lots, I think the threshold is... It's 1,000 square feet on the larger lots.
Okay, because there was some discussion on that it didn't meet the standards maybe for manufactured homes or something like that created a problem within.
Yeah, we've heard that some of the manufactured homes are built obviously to manufactured standards, and I think there are some units there that are slightly over 1,000 that otherwise would be well suited as second units. So I think that's a good issue for the Council Commission to raise. If you want to give us direction to bring that back, or that we should have policies to make the second unit ordinance a little bit more flexible to accommodate manufactured housing, that's the kind of input we're looking for tonight.
I'd be interested in that, just the number, not revisiting the whole second unit ordinance. And the other thing was I read where the state is wanting us or municipalities to go from the RMF-16 to an RMF-20 minimum. Have we thought about that at all? Or?
That actually is true. The recent legislation came out, AB 2348, looking at minimum densities for the very low and low income units. They'll be looking at us to be able to accommodate those units at 20 dwelling units to the acre. They have a provision that you can make an argument that we can produce higher density affordable housing at a lower threshold, but it's difficult to get it through the certification process along those lines. So they'll be looking for 20 units to the acre. One of the things to think about for the rezoning, though, or meeting the RENA numbers, is that we, at this point, for moving the housing element forward, is we need to have a program in the housing element that the city's willing to do this. We don't actually have to do it in this process. For the current RENA, you need to rezone in that planning period, which goes to 2014. For the previous RENA, you need to have a program that says that you'll do the rezones within 1 year of adoption.
I see. So if we considered changing, you know, our RMF 16 to RMF 20, would that benefit us in any way in our...
Yeah, then you would meet the requirement. We would meet the RENA numbers, and that would be exactly what the state's looking for.
Yeah, because we had a hard time coming from RMF 12 to RMF 16, so...
Yeah, I know. I understand.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Councilmember Kelly?
Yes, regarding the second units in the mobile homes, I attended the ribbon-cutting ceremony for the mobile home sales yard up there at San Anselmo on the freeway, and that topic did come up for discussion, that the mobile home units, they kind of have a jig, and they come in certain sizes, and to modify that size.
Manufactured.
Okay, mobile. As long as I don't say trailer.
Right.
But anyhow, Jim is working with those people. They're going to bring some of their floor plans to Jim to see if we can work it together so we can get a standard size of one of those manufactured homes that'll fit into our process that we have.
Planning Commissioner Jack?
When indicating the number of units per acre, can you use, do you have to come up with a specific hard number, or can you use up to, like 20?
It's actually a minimum of 20.
Oh, it's a minimum.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Other questions? Okay, then. Go ahead.
We have quite a bit of property that's already zoned or actually has some projects that are approved that are kind of sitting. How does that work in regards to our requirements, the state requirements?
We can use pending projects to reduce the allocation. If it's gone through the planning process, we can use those to reduce the allocation. So we're working with staff to get our arms around those numbers to see how they measure up against what the state requirements are. So building permits can be applied, and then planning permits too.
Okay, thank you.
Councilmember Kelly?
Getting back to a clarification on the numbers, I think when we initially addressed this some years ago that the city was allocated 1,880-some units that we had to have zoned. What is it going to be now? Is there an increase to that? And what is the total number? And how many have we achieved? And how many more do we have to create?
The total number for very low and low is 762 units. Let me pull that slide back up. So this shows the previous RENA and the current RENA. The total allocation for both periods is 2,175 units. Yeah, I know that's a lot, looking at, you know, just what the, how the city's been built out, and even going back to 1990 with census data. But what the state really wants us to focus on is the very low and low income. Although the state law is a market-based approach, the city doesn't build anything. They just want us to remove barriers and to let the process unfold as it will. But what we need to be concerned about up here is the very low and low allocation, which is 762 units in total.
From the beginning, how many have we achieved during the last 8 or 10 years? How many can we say that we've created?
According to our preliminary work with the city, it looks like it's about 100.
100?
Well, very low, low, and moderate, so deed restricted units. Much more above moderate, though, so we'll track those, too, in the element.
Planning Commissioner Schmidt.
Yes. Just doing quick math, we're talking about roughly 38 acres of land that would be needed to meet the 762 units at the very low levels. Do we have any idea of what's available at this point? I'm using the 20 units per acre.
Our preliminary numbers show it. I actually don't remember the acres off the top of my head, but it shows that we can accommodate at 10 and 16 units to the acre, almost 600 units. So if we start to analyze those and start to upzone some of those, we'll be able to meet the allocation. I actually have to give me a minute. I might be able to pull out those numbers. Or my lovely assistant might be able to.
And then the state requires a minor analysis done to see if 20 units or 18 or 14 can be built, correct?
Well, if we go with 20, the state's fine with that. We don't really have to do any further analysis. If we try to get below that, then we need to do some more detailed analysis, and it's a bit of a fight.
Okay, thank you.
Planning Commissioner Moreno.
Curious, is it possible to meet the needs without being certified? I'm not saying we don't want to be certified. I'm just for my own information.
I actually think it's possible, not to jump through all the state hoops for if a city was really willing to do things like work with the homeless and social programs and bring a lot of interesting creative ideas to the table. But I do think certification is important, and I think it's becoming more important. So I think it's an important step for the community. But, yeah, I think, all of the things equal, it will be possible to accommodate the fair share, the local fair share, and other means. Mm-hmm.
And so what is – you had mentioned that state funds are tied to having the housing element certified. What is the benefit or the purpose of having a certified element aside from the state funds?
Well, your health element is one of your seven elements of the general plan, so if it's not found in compliance, your whole general plan can be litigated. That's another thing. More and more nonprofit groups are coming after jurisdictions that don't have an adopted certified element. You put yourself at risk for litigation, mostly litigation and funding.
Okay. That's helpful because I thought with the state of the California economy, I didn't want to rely on state funds as our big motivator.
Well, that's actually a good point, too. And the state has said before that there's not enough funding to meet all the very low and low-income households that we need to provide for. So that's kind of been out there, too. It's something they've seen before. Nonetheless, they want jurisdictions to eliminate barriers, put their best foot forward to meet the fair share.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Councilmember Clay?
Yeah, my question was similar. What if we just tell the state we ain't doing it? I mean, what can they do to us or what?
Well, it's up to the Planning Commission and Council to make those decisions. It's not my responsibility as a consultant to recommend that to the city. But, that again, I think you're open for litigation. We have worked with jurisdictions who have been sued over this. It's very expensive. And there's funding opportunities out there that I think the city would be interested in pursuing over the long term. You also have that anti-NIMBY legislation, which I forgot to mention, what we talked about before. So if you don't have a certified housing element, somebody wants to come in and put together a project, you can't make the findings to deny it. That could get caught, tied up in court. The state pendulum swing towards, even in this economy, they haven't gone back to, making these requirements more onerous, really, on local jurisdictions.
So they kind of got you over the barrel then, so to speak. Thank you.
Planning Commissioner Sturdivant.
Yes, that your slide up on the screen right now shows 2001 through 2014. And if I understand correctly, from 2001 till now, current, we have not been certified and we have not met our goals. Is that correct? When it comes to housing?
The housing element was adopted but not certified by the state. That was something the city was working on. A lot of it had to do with, I think, the vacant land inventory and the density plus the size of the numbers. I think the city is in a better position now to kind of move forward and have a certified housing element, and there's more reasons to do so. But, yeah, you have not had a certified housing element to date.
And we also, we have not met our goals, have we, when it comes to the numbers?
No, you haven't met the goals, but a lot of jurisdictions have not met the goals because they are fairly large. And as I said before, there's not enough funding out there, subsidized funding, to meet the very low and low-income household needs, which require pretty deep subsidies. But the staff and the city has been working with nonprofits, people, self-help housing, moving, you know, to the extent they can, I think, some really positive projects forward and positive programs forward.
Thank you.
Planning Commissioner Benz.
Yes. Is it still possible to work in conjunction or in a joint venture with the county or another city to meet some of our low and moderate income housing needs and get credit for it?
At this point, since the regional housing plan needs is done, and the county's actually already submitted their housing element to the state, I think most of those doors are closed to the city, and it requires reciprocal agreements between the jurisdictions. So I would say it's unlikely, maybe not impossible.
Is it closed by law, or could we open it by law?
Under state law, you would need a reciprocal agreement for one jurisdiction to take your allocation. And it's infrequent that another jurisdiction would agree to do that, but it's not closed by law, to my knowledge.
Councilmember Clay?
Yeah. Our housing element was kind of looked at for quite a while as a model for the county. So if we're not certified, are any cities or is the county certified?
I know various cities are certified, actually, and I think the county was certified last time, too, but Grover Beach was certified. Pismo Beach was not certified. Arroyo Grande was certified. Not sure about the city of San Luis Obispo. I believe they were certified, too, off the top of my head. But
I'd be surprised because they don't have housing for anybody there. We provide the housing for them. Anyway, how about Paso Robles? Do you know that?
I'm not sure about Paso either, off the top of my head, if they were certified or not. Sorry.
Planning Commissioner Schmidt?
Yes. In that our present plan hasn't been certified, and this might be a more appropriate question for staff, is how has that hurt us? Have we not gotten some grants that we wanted to get? I'm particularly not turned off by or thrown away by possible litigation. I do think that there's ways of preparing a housing element in which you can provide protection within it and still meet some of the state requirements and have the information available if someone does want to challenge you. And again, there's many agencies within our county who haven't had it certified, and how many lawsuits have there been? I mean, there's always a potential, but is it real? So staff, was there any detriment to the city by not having a certified document these last couple of years?
I don't believe there was any detriments, but we do not have available some housing funds, and there are a couple projects that we have been in recent discussions with developers about that potentially would benefit if these funds were available. So I think in the future, as we try to do more creative financing, especially with some of our redevelopment funds that we have set aside, the availability to possibly incorporate some other state funding programs may be helpful. So I don't think it's hurt us in the past, but I think it would be a benefit in the future if we had the availability to use those as an option.
Is there any thought about increasing the redevelopment area? I mean, doesn't redevelopment funds have to be used within the redevelopment area? And how many parcels are available in the redevelopment zone for housing? It seems to me if we're talking about potentially using those funds, how realistic is that?
Well, the redevelopment area is fairly large. It goes from basically Home Depot at the north end of town down to the Albertsons Shopping Center along El Camino Real, and then goes out Moore Road to Kerberil and then back along Traffic Way to the Salinas River. So it's a very large area. There's thousands of parcels within there. So there's no limit or no problem with the number of available sites potentially. Yes, we could spend redevelopment set-aside money outside the agency boundary. We just don't get the same amount of credit, so you get basically half the credit. credit. So you get the most bang for the buck if you spend the money within the district. In terms of the question of expanding the district, there's a significant number of financial and technical and legal problems with doing that, and that isn't something that staff would recommend as a good use of staff time at this point.
Thank you.
Planning Commissioner Benz?
Yes. I don't know who to direct the question to, but can the city get credit for increasing its low and moderate rental units as opposed to owner-occupied?
Yes. Yeah, rental or owner-occupied units, you get credit for those.
So the city could acquire some larger apartment complexes and hire an outside contractor to handle the low and moderate income portion of it, to track it, and to use redevelopment agency funds to write down some of the costs or some of the closing costs or the costs of getting people to move in and out.
There is options under state law to take market rate housing and deed restrict it and move it into the affordable category and to get credit for that under the arena. It's called an alternative sites analysis that we'd have to do to make sure we met the letter of the law, but it is definitely an option for the city.
Thank you.
Planning Commissioner Schmidt.
Yes, another question about the various lowest end of the housing. There's been a little bit of discussion in our community about the providing of housing for seniors and care facilities and so on. Do they qualify for that level?
Senior housing qualifies.
Daycare or living, or, you know what I mean?
What counts as a unit actually is it can be an attached or detached, but it has to be a standalone unit with its own kitchen facilities. So that's what counts as a unit against the RENA. It's the HUD definition of a housing unit, and it has to have its own kitchen and bathroom facilities. So somebody in another jurisdiction wanted to know if a convent would qualify. But if there was separate kitchen facilities, it qualifies. If there's common areas, it does not.
Okay.
Any other questions? Planning Commissioner Warren.
Yes, thank you. I read the 24-page report, and I did not go snowblind doing it, but I made a few comments in the margin, and I thought I'd mention this to you. Basically, this is all based on roughly a $71,000 median income for the city, right?
Yes.
Okay. One of my questions is that in the last several years, there's been a real increase in the number of retired people that live here. They do not have high incomes, but they have fairly high net worths, and they can afford a, you know, rather substantial home, and that's what they're doing. So my question is this 106 units that the state's demanding us to provide, is that based on those numbers taking into account the retired people? Are they considered poor people in this community?
Actually, they are, because the numbers are based on income, not net worth. So they look at income levels when they do these analysis, and they don't really get into the detail you're talking about, fortunately or unfortunately. They look at population projections and workforce projections, and then they allocate that locally. But this even starts at the bigger level, at the state level, with the state looking at population projections and turning that into household units, and they don't take into all the regional differences when they do that. It's more of a big picture thing. And again, demographics have changed in some of our analysis for the 1990 census. But those are the kind of things we can definitely talk about in the housing element, the new statistics, what's going on, how the community has changed, and how we want to address that. I think those are great comments. But the allocation doesn't really get into that level of detail.
Okay. Okay, I got two other comments. If you drive around this city, there are literally hundreds of granny flats in backyards, RVs where people are living there permanently. They're probably under the radar in terms of, you know, being legitimate. but yet in fact they are providing hundreds of units for low-income people. And I don't know, I think that needs to be, you know, cranked into the equation here. And I had a number of other comments, but I think this is a unique community, and I don't think a cookie-cutter formula basically fits this community. And I think we're being overly burdened with the number of low-cost housing, because there are a number of houses where you got two or three family units living in one house. Now, does that qualify as three units or one unit? So, again, I don't think this, and I'll spare you my lecture on this whole thing, but I don't think a cookie-cutter formula fits this community. And I think the retirement factor and a lot of other factors enter into that, and I would hope that at the end of the day, that would be taken into consideration. That's the end of my rant, by the way.
Other questions? Council Member
Chuck,
Clay?
Chuck brings up a good point. You know, there are a number of retirees that maybe pay cash for their property and don't have the 71,000 income. How do we track that? How do we, you know...
Those will come out in the news. These are all good comments, and Atascadero is a unique community. We'll try to capture that as we move the housing element forward. Those come out with the new census data. The old census data did show that 49% of senior households were in the very low and low-income categories for income threshold. It doesn't measure net worth, just looking at income levels. I think some of the comments about second units and RVs are indicators of some of the affordability issues, even though the housing prices have come down, are still persistent in the city. One of the things on second units, though, is we can take those into account against our fair share arena numbers. So to the extent we can document, we're working with the city staff to come up with a number of units, looking at the affordability levels for those, so we can count those against the arena allocation numbers. And to the extent we can document that they're affordable to low-income households, we can even kind of move them down into those lower-income categories.
Planning Commissioner Schmidt.
Yes, Chuck brought up a great comment about the numbers of people living in the household. I've kind of joked around. To me, it's the new American household, and you can see it when you drive down the street, and there's 10 cars parked out in front of a house, and you know that there's multiple families living in there. Has anyone tried to broach that question with the state and try to take into account that you have a household and there are multiple families there?
One of the things we document in the housing element is the number of families living in a household or housing unit. What the state's looking for, though, is overcrowding. So if there's more than 1.5 persons per room, not including bathrooms and kitchens, that's defined as overcrowding by the state. Those are some of the things we'll be looking for. Besides the census, so that information's hard to track. So again, we get back to kind of the stale information, which is a little bit of a problem with the housing element update. To the extent we have any qualitative data or any data from the city that we want to supplement the housing element update process with, we can certainly do that, but there's not a lot of hard facts on that kind of information out there.
Councilmember Clay?
Yeah, I have a question for Warren. Warren, in the past on second units, we had like an amnesty program that went on for, what, 2-3 years or something like that? I suppose that's passed now.
Yeah, we actually ran the amnesty program for 4 years, from 2004 through 2008. What that allowed was these granny units that had been converted into full-fledged living units with kitchens, that they could come in and basically get those permitted and recognized as second units. That program has expired at this point, but that's the kind of input we're looking for tonight, is if the council's interested in a new version of that program.
That was my question. Do you think that might bring in a few more of these, for lack of a better word, illegal units?
It did seem like we got throughout the period, the 4 years, it seemed like, you know, we got you know, maybe five or six every year. So there seemed like there was somewhat a regular stream. Some of them would be just triggered by enforcement cases where one was discovered and their only way to comply was to use the amnesty program. So it did seem like it had some utility. I think it did bring probably a couple dozen more units in that we wouldn't have gotten otherwise.
The other thing is in regards to sales of property, why having a conforming versus non-conforming second unit is much more valuable and much more easy to sell. So I would be in favor of bringing that program back and allowing people to come back in.
Councilmember Kelly?
I know that program was accepted when it came out, but one of the problems I had several people call me when I was on the Planning Commission, what have you, was the issue with water meters, that people did want to make that second unit legal until they had to pay $15,000 or $16,000 for another water meter when they've been using water off the main meter for the house. So I think as a city, and I don't know how you would do it, but we need to get together with our water company, try to come to a happy agreement where we can kind of work together and eliminate some of these high costs.
And perhaps not just water, it may be electrical or gas lines as well. Council Member Clay? Excuse me. Planning Commissioner Clay? Clay. Ward. Chuck. Woo, there's too many of you. Go ahead, Chuck.
Also, that was a
Clay
compliment,
my father.
We look alike. Anyway, thank you. I looked into this years ago, and I think one of the problems was that the fees were so abusively high that it precluded anybody from bringing those units, and a lot of them were in bad shape, bringing them up to code. So it was a catch-22 thing. If they went in there, they got hit with a $15,000-$16,000 fee, which they couldn't afford, then they didn't have any money left to fix the place up. So they just said the heck with it, and you've got a bad situation. My idea, I mean, if the fees were dropped down, they're using the same amount of water anyway. They're using the same amount of gas anyway. So I don't see what the big deal is. And it would certainly clean up a lot of neighborhoods if the fees were reasonable, because they're going to turn around, they're going to spend that money on fixing the place up. And I think that's where the emphasis should be, because it just didn't work for those reasons. Maybe I'm just applying a level of common sense here, but it's a catch-22 thing. So I'd like your comment on that, because I think there is a gold mine of low-cost housing that's filling the need of this community.
Councilmember Kelly.
Just a tagline on fees. When the economy was going real well and they were building a lot of so-called affordable housing or houses on the lower end, the fees ranged anywhere from 30 to 45% just for fees before you even started the house. So I think I've always thought that if the city wants to be involved with an affordable housing program, we should really be involved and really look at those fees. A lot of times you'll have a little mini subdivision with maybe 10 to 15 homes in it, and you have three floor plans. I don't know why we have to charge full fees for a duplication of a plan check. I know we have to, recover some of our costs and what have you, but I think the city needs to become part of the program also.
Other questions?
Well, I got one more, yeah.
Oh, what? What's right? Wait your turn, hold on. Planning Commissioner Schmidt.
I think that emphasizes the point of the need to get a plan that's certified. I mean, the idea of using CBDG funds to maybe augment fees on water meters, if we can reduce the price down to $8,000 versus the $12,000 by using grant monies to help people out, then that would be an appropriate thing to do. And then again, to emphasize, get the plan certified by the state so make those things available to us.
Councilmember Clay?
Yeah, well, on the fees, you have to make a nexus that they're appropriate. But the other thing is on the water meters, there may be a way going back, so to speak. In other words, if the second unit or granny unit was, say, built in 1990 or something like that, to convince the water company that they should go back to the 1990 figures in regards to the meter fee, that might be a possibility. we have a second house that's actually on another lot, and it never had a water meter. I mean, in those days, I don't think they even had water meters, but they went back, and I think it cost us $2,500 versus the $10,000 or something like that because they went back. So there may be some way to work with the water company, but the fee thing, we need to make the nexus. We just can't reduce fees and then eat the amount if that's the case. I don't want to pay for someone else's fees. Maybe Bob does. I don't know.
Any more questions? I had a couple. I wondered how we figure out what the balance is between rental property and homes that would be owned. And I wondered, since you're doing the study, whether you've contacted any property management companies to see what the vacancy rate is. In other words, they put a rental on the market. Does it immediately get snapped up, or it stays on the market for a considerable length of time, kind of pointing to an overabundance or an underabundance of rental properties?
These are good questions. We actually did talk to the Tuscadero Association of Realtors for some of the information on what's going on with the market. And we have talked to the Chamber and our stakeholder interviews last week to get a feel for what the business community was thinking. The Association of Realtors talked about vacancies being up, prices being down, some of those concerns. In terms of the breakdown between rental housing and ownership housing, it's really up to the city as to how we want to pursue this. Right now, most nonprofits and affordable housing providers feel it's more efficient to provide rental housing to lower-income households, but it's, of course, up to the city if they want to pursue first-time homebuyer programs or some other kind of gap funding. Either way, you get credit against your arena for it. It's just a matter of allocation of funds and what direction the city wants to go.
And I have a question. We have a homeless or emergency shelter, if you'd like to call it, called ECHO. And I'd like to know if we get credit for that, or we're really starting from this point forward and we really don't get credit for it.
We're starting from this point forward on the homeless issue, but we do get credit for that to the extent that we have talked to ECHO. We understand their services. We'll document that in the housing element. The state looks upon that favorably. So that does look in our favor, and we get credit for that. But for the SB2, we need to look forward and zoning for a shelter.
And a question regarding single-room occupancy. It was mentioned in the report, and I'm wondering if we can get credit for advertisements in the paper, for instance, for roommates or room for rent, those kind of things, or how do we track single-room occupancies?
SROs could count, like if we wanted to transition a hotel or something to an SRO and count those as a unit, but for just advertising, sharing, apartments and things like that, we have to actually create a new unit for the housing allocation.
A new unit. Could you explain that further? I'm not understanding that.
A new unit is defined by HUD as a standalone, or it can be an attached unit that has a separate kitchen facilities. That's what they're looking for. So Cal Poly, San Luis Obispo, not too long ago, got into a conversation about their dormitories and could they count for dorms. And they got most of the dorms counted because they were set up as little apartments. But the extent that you have common areas and common eating facilities, that does not count as a unit.
So in terms of cooking facilities, could that be something as simple as a microwave, or would it need to be a full kitchen?
It can be pretty simple, I believe, but we could kind of get into the gray areas there, too.
So another point perhaps we'd like to talk
mm-hmm.
about further.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and under state law, according to the report, it sounds like the county can distribute some of their units to cities if there is a severe service level concern. And I just wondered if you could let us know what that means. We have quite a few areas in our county that have water shortages, for instance, Templeton or Cayugas or Cambria. And I can see that the county would try to give them to an area such as Atascadero that has a mutual water company and actually has enough water. Is this something that we need to consider when we put together our housing element?
This could be a potential concern for the city. I know the county does have level of service issues, but the county has already prepared their housing element and submitted to the state. So it's my understanding they're not looking to allocate any of their units to anybody else. They're already much further along in the process.
Okay, very good. I'm glad to hear that. A question regarding lost affordable units that we may have had in the city due to foreclosure. I'd like to know if there's some way that we can close that loophole, that if a person in this, an affordable unit that's deed restricted goes into foreclosure, I understand that everything is wiped off the books and it goes back to a market rate.
Yeah, we've been talking with staff about the foreclosure issue a little bit. This is a maybe an unfortunate circumstance. I haven't gone through all the deed restrictions that the city set up to date to look at what the circumstances with that was. It's possible that when the bank has a when the primary financing went through, that the bank requested that so that they could liquidate the property, but the staff might have more to add on that.
Yeah, we've gone through a couple iterations of our deed restrictions, but our latest ones that were developed, they have a provision where the city has the first right of refusal. I think to meet some of the HUD financing requirements, we had to have some sort of provision in there where the lender could basically wipe out the affordable requirement. But we have the right of first refusal, so they have to come to us and give us the opportunity to buy it or intervene. So I think we've been contacted once or twice on that issue. I'm not sure if we've actually lost any units yet, but that is something that we're monitoring, and it is an issue that we just need to be aware of and working on.
Mm-hmm. And I'm going to ask one more, and then I'll go back to you. Hold on just one moment. One of the issues that Atascadero has that you probably should be aware of is that we've had a very very concerted effort to intersperse our affordable housing along with our other units, because we felt that it would fit in better with our community not to put them in one area, because those have been found to be magnets for crime and other issues. So when new development comes in, we very carefully put them in so that they don't look any different, and there's no differences from the outward appearance in our affordable units. But what I'm seeing here with this zoning, let's say 20 units per acre, there is no way that we could do that as far as I can tell. Can you explain how we could do that?
That's another good comment, too, and I know the city has an inclusionary ordinance that's been effective. But when you upzone, though, one of the complaints is that there's no guarantee that it's market rate or affordable housing. So the inclusionary goal of the city, I think, is a worthy goal and could still be pursued even at a little bit higher density, moving from 16 to 20, because you could get, you know, market rate projects coming in at that rate that had to have a percentage of affordable.
So would it be possible for the city to review each project and rezone as the project comes in if it would accommodate it? Or it sounds like to me the regulations that the state is giving us, like one of our planning commissioners says, is rather cookie cutter, and they say make this part of town 20 units and over here 1 unit per acre.
They're looking for the minimum 20 units per acre, so upzoning that high density residential zone, for instance, to a minimum of 20. In addition, the state, to meet your allocation, and I didn't mention it before, you can meet it with some mixed-use commercial areas, but they're looking for at least half of it to be residential only.
I see.
Residential only zone.
Okay, thank you. I believe it was Council Member Clay.
Yeah, I just, Warren, is that silent second that you're talking about?
That is part of the program in terms of not only having the first right of refusal, we often have a silent second that puts us in some sort of position where if there is a default that we get to come to the table to negotiate exactly how the unit's disposed of.
And you're saying there's only been a couple so far that's come?
Yeah, I know there's a couple that we've dealt with the finance department over the last year or so.
And then I wasn't clear when you mentioned the vacancy factor. I mean, I've been riding my bicycle around town quite a bit here lately, and I notice a lot of for rent signs everywhere. So what did you find out about the vacancy factor right now in Atascadero?
Actually, unfortunately, I don't remember that off the top of my head, but when I talked to the realtor, he didn't indicate that it was excessively high, but maybe I'll have to go back and research that a little bit further with him.
Thank you.
One thing to add on, there is some commercial information that's available that tracks rental vacancies and rental prices, and staff has ordered a copy of that. It's produced by a company that actually does surveys of rental markets, so we're going to be getting that in the next month or so. We'll use that in the housing element, and I think that'll answer a lot of the questions that the council's had about the inventory and the cost and the rental rates, that sort of thing.
Thank you, Warren.
The other thing about that is I think the vacancy rates in the cities have been low, kind of lower than average, so that if you kind of get up to more of an average 5% or a little bit higher, it's going to seem like there's more vacancies, but because it's been unusually low in the past economy, it's just going to feel different.
Planning Commissioner Benz?
Yes. I'm the president of a local nonprofit organization that deals with adults that have autism, Down syndrome, or are severely mentally and physically challenged. And we have four homes, of which we house six adults in each home. Is there any way that the city can get credit for that?
We can get credit for new group homes, but not existing group homes. Although if they were established in the current or previous planning period, we can take credit for those if they're deed restricted and they target certain income levels.
These were, it doesn't require any income level.
Okay. So extremely low, maybe?
I guess these homes were created back in the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
And we have maintained them. We've bought new ones and sold the old ones. And but there's not any way of getting any credit or reducing our population count for housing requirements. And I would throw in Ash Hospital also.
These are good points. We should talk to you and get more of the details about the homes and when they were set up and how we can take credit for those and document those in the housing element. The disabled population is something we do a lot of work on in the housing element to document that as a special housing need. We recognize it's a housing need in the city, actually in most cities, and it's something that people don't expect when we show the numbers how high it is, people with certain disabilities. So that's an important component of our study, and I'd like to talk to you a little bit more about your nonprofit and the work you do and how we can take credit for that in the housing element.
There are several nonprofit agencies doing the same thing here in Atascadero, so just brought it up for discussion. Thank you.
Planning Commissioner Schmidt.
Yes. You had your discussion about our inclusionary housing ordinance. Is there anything that we could do to add language in that ordinance to be able to get credit for having it? I mean, could we say that a certain amount of houses have to be a low to moderate income or very, very low and somehow quantify it that way so we can get some credit for doing it?
The city can set up the inclusionary ordinance. There's lots of flexibility. There's nothing in state law that says you have to do one thing or the other, so you have a lot of discretion as to how you set up the ordinance. I know the city recently went through a study of the ordinance and looking at how it was working with another firm. We have some preliminary results of that. But it already does, I think, set some threshold for targeting different households, very low, low, moderate. We could review those and see if we wanted to have a higher percentage or more targeted towards very low or low-income households, deeper, you know, more subsidies from the redevelopment agency, those kind of things. So we can work with the Planning Commission and Council going back to the ordinance and thinking about ways to revise it to meet the fair share numbers.
Thank you.
Councilmember Clay?
Yeah. Mr. Benson mentioned the Atascadero State Hospital. Can we get credit for the patients out there?
No kitchen, Jerry.
I just asked the question.
Yeah, it comes down to the definition of a unit again, and that it doesn't meet the definition of a unit unless they have on-site facilities for employees or some kind of worker housing.
They do have some workforce
housing.
Yeah.
It would depend on when that was established and then the income levels. Yeah.
Just trying.
This is good brainstorming. That's what we need to do.
I have a question regarding what Commissioner Benz was talking about with the disabled housing. If they were to go in and remodel them, would we then get credit, or does it have to be a brand new unit?
Remodeling existing units that set aside for group housing, but establishing new group housing units, yes. It's a matter of sort of, since we're going to the existing planning period plus the previous planning period, we can take credit for things that came online back to 2001. So
if they were to sell theirs and go to another one, then at that point it would qualify, correct?
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't have to be brand new. It just has to be a new use.
Right.
Got it. Okay. Thank you. Other questions? Okay. Thank you very much, Ms. Wise. Let's open it to the public for public comment.
Good evening. Mike Jackson, Tascadero. Having experienced a lot with a lot of people in this room, I have some questions. there are people on the Planning Commission presently that have spoke vehemently against affordable units. There was a project on El Corte that the city planners suggested that they build 10 units and some of them be, very low income. And some of the people on the Planning Commission spoke up and said no, so it was reduced from 10 lots to 7, which made it not feasible in some respects, and it's been foreclosed on. And that's not what I'm getting at. I'm getting at the fact that there are people here that have spoke extremely against affordable units and multiple units in their neighborhood. We need to look at that. Also, we need to look at the planning staff. I had a project I was trying to put forward. I couldn't get past the design of the columns or the offset of the garage or the shade of the color of the units. Down here on Santa Isabel, there's 4 brown boxes that have no offset on the garage. There's no porches, no columns that sit in foreclosure at this time. But they were approved. Now, where is the status? Where is the continuity of the planning department, the planning commission? And there are people sitting on the city council that were at the planning commission that voted against my project. I couldn't get an in-load garage approved because it didn't have an offset. I was trying to build 3 very modest single-level units that were within walking distance of downtown. I couldn't get past colors. I couldn't get past anything. And there are people, that developers here in town, that had to bring in color swatches of stucco to get the right shade because they didn't want to take a color board. That wasn't enough. I want to know if that's changed. I want to know what has changed in the city and the planning staff and the planning commission, the people that are on it. They're going to make it where we can have affordable units in this town. I've been here 33 years. I've been in real estate for over 22. And the stone walls that are thrown up against people that try to bring stuff forward is incredible. I spoke to city managers. I spoke to everybody when I was trying to do my project. I couldn't get anywhere with it. But yet, it just frosts me that these brown boxes on San Isabel get built. When I had to have porches, I had to have offsets, and other people had to send their stuff back continuously it has to be colony. It has to be this, it has to be that. Well, there's different standards for different people, evidently, by what's been built and what's gone on in this town.
Mr.
And
Jackson, your time is up. Thank you. Would someone else like to comment?
Good evening, Chuck Treat with JRW Group in Paso Robles, California. We actually own a project on El Camino, 40 units mixed use. Planning Commission approved. Roberta, you're on the Planning Commission then, and also City Council approved with zoning of 20 units per acre or higher. The project sits fully entitled and is and currently, hopefully, in the last plan check with California CoCheck. This project has been very hard. We've been trying to do affordable housing utilizing tax credits to the state of California, either federal and state credits, and also various soft money programs. As you know, doing affordable housing, it takes deep affordability as far as the soft money gap financing to make it happen. Unfortunately, it's been very difficult over the last couple of years to get financing due to the fact that the city of Atascadero does not have a housing element in place. And because of that, it's hindered us to be able to actually move forward on this project. So we are very encouraged to see you guys taking this step, and we want to encourage you to keep going forward on this step. And at the same time, we've also submitted a package to the Redevelopment Agency and your finance committee to help us possibly help fund the soft money gap for the 40 units of affordable housing, which would be actually very low income to low income for the city of Atascadero. So we are very encouraged to see you guys taking this step, and I want to encourage you not to get sidetracked and to move forward. So thank you.
Thank you. We have a question for you, Mr. Schaefer.
Yeah.
Councilman.
Isn't that a mixed-use project, though?
It is a mixed-use. It has about 2,000 square feet, which would be a community room, which will have homework centers in there for the kids, and also other training facilities within that 2,000 square feet. We have 6,000 square feet. It'll be commercial space for rent, and the rest of it is 40 units, hopefully of affordable housing at not market rate, although we're looking at all avenues right now if we can't get the soft money financing to do affordable in the city of Atascadero.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Colin Brown of Atascadero. When you're speaking of fees, remember the building permit and the water meters and the school fees are not the only fees that you get stuck with on this. You've got an engineer for the septic tank. You've got to have engineer for the trusses. You've got to have engineer fees for the seismic. You've got to have an engineer fee for the soils. The county or the city will not accept the UBC if you put in your foundation according to the UBC. You have to have a grading and driveway engineer. And you have to have structural work. So what was that rate? What was the value of your low-income house? Yes.
The affordability threshold for a moderate income household was about $300,000.
I don't think you can build a second unit for $300,000. I recently completed a second unit, and it was right at $200,000 by the time I got done with it, and that was not including any value of property in it or anything else. It was on my own property that I had already. And so if you're trying to build a second unit on a new piece of property with another house on there, you're going to be up into the 300,000 bracket, and that's just too far. I had over about 50,000 involved in fees when you add them all up by the time you hire a soils engineer. And the part of that I didn't really like is I'm an engineer, and they wouldn't accept my own signature and my number. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Brown.
Hi, my name is Ron Behrman. I live at 9990 Old Morrill Road East here in town. I heard Mr. Ward talk about affordable units or second units that were illegal. I think that's a good thought, but my point would be that I think there's a lot of people in town that would consider building second units or granny units, if that's what you want to call them. I heard the manufactured home come up today, which is an encouragement, because certainly I think that could go on a permanent foundation and fit right in with the architecture of an existing house. What I really have a problem with are the fees that Mr. Brown talked about. When you build a 1,000-square-foot granny unit and you got $40,000 to $50,000 in fees, this is not affordable anymore. I don't understand why we have to have a second water meter, a second address, all of those things. I think a second unit could have a meter that would run that unit that would be acceptable to the water company, not have to put in another meter. And it certainly doesn't cost $18,000 to put a meter in. So we need to really look at the cost, not only from the water standpoint, what we can put on there, if it needs to be moved up to 1,020 feet to fit a standard plan for a manufacturer, I think that would help. And I think to reach the numbers you're talking about, I heard that we haven't even done, 100 so far to meet the 1,700? That's ridiculous. And that's since 2001, that we've only come up with 100 units. Is that what I heard tonight, of the 1,700?
Go ahead, Warren.
That was just referring to the very low and low-income units. In terms of the moderate and above-moderate income units, we are much, much closer to hitting our allocations on those.
Thank you.
So on the individual groups, in the other allocations, you're closer to meeting those goals? Correct. Okay. All right. But my point being, we need to look at all the options we have on the table to accomplish what the state is telling us. Nobody likes to be told what to do by government or anybody else. I hate to be told what I have to do. But if that's the way it is, we need to find a way to accommodate that in the least expensive way possible, to put fees like we have now on people that want to build, whether it's a builder or whether it's a homeowner, to put a second unit in. Those fees don't calculate. If a builder is going to build something, he needs a profit, reasonable profit. And if those fees are too high to take them out of the affordability range, then nothing's going to work. We really need to look hard at what these fees are.
Thank you. Would anybody else like to speak? Yes, you may.
Roland Brown again. I'm stuck on the cost of building. What I forgot to emphasize on there was on the one that I just finished at $200,000. It had no property costs involved, and it had about 25% labor because I did the work myself on it. And we're talking about right around $200,000. If you put the property into it, you can see where it would be.
I got a question.
Go ahead.
So how did that figure out per square foot?
Over $200, $200 a square foot.
See, and how does that, you're a builder.
No, I'm not.
But well, what you're associated with the building.
Yeah.
Okay, my point is how does that compare to just building a house?
Well, the value per square foot for these smaller houses that you're talking about is higher than for a larger house because you have the high values of bathrooms and all plumbing and all that stuff spread over a smaller area.
Right.
So it's not a good comparison, but it's related to the value of the smaller houses for the low income.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Regarding the affordability, I've recently been doing
investigation. Could you state your name just one more time?
Oh, Mike Jackson. Thank you. I know who I am. Sometimes. But anyway, the city has a lot of projects that have been approved that sit idle in some state of improvement or not, a lot of lots setting. The investors are contacting realtors, and they're wanting to know the value of the lots. And basically, we have to tell them the lots are worth nothing because of the market. The way it is right now, the affordability, what the market is on housing, it costs as much to build as it does. You can buy something that's already built. So the city has an opportunity to step up and offer these people that own these lots, the investors or whoever they are, some kind of incentives to help them get them built out, and they can get some affordable housing out of that, I believe. But right now, the cost of building on these lots is what the market price is on a unit. And when you tell somebody that their lots are worth nothing, they don't understand that. So, anyway.
I have a question for Mike.
Go ahead, Council Member.
I don't want to get you all riled up now, Mike, but I don't think your project ever came before the City Council. Right?
No. I'm not talking about mine. I'm a real estate broker.
Okay.
I've been doing broker price opinions for investors.
Okay. Because I thought you said your project came.
It came before the Planning Commission.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Yeah. That's right.
Yes. But the price of the existing projects that are sitting there, the lots that are approved, they got site. Some of them have site improvements in, but the lots aren't worth anything because it costs so much to build. Is there anything the city can do to entice these people to build these lots out and put structures on there instead of having them sitting there, vacant and disrepair? I mean, there's an opportunity to get some affordable housing out of that. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Jackson. Is there anyone else that would like to speak? Seeing none, I'm going to close the public comment period and bring it back to the joint session for deliberation. One moment. That would be Planning Commissioner Schmidt.
Yes, I think some of the comments were valid from the public. And I'll give an example. I had a friend who wanted to build a conventional garage on his property and using the EVC or the CBC requirements. And to get it permitted, we had to engineer it, which was ridiculous. And for those who don't know, the UBC and the CBC have standards, conventional constructions. In the past, it has been if you design a house or structure to those conventional standards, there's no need to have structural analysis or anything else done on it. And so I do have personal experience with it, and obviously some people here have had experience with it also, where maybe our city should recognize some of those things.
Thank you. Councilmember Clay?
Yeah, I know Bob's been working on this a lot, but I think that, you know, we can take a good look at our fees, and maybe there's some areas that we can make some improvements on. The other thing on fees on second units, and I want to make this very clear, I think it's the water company that's demanding the water meter. It had nothing to do with the city. Is that right, Warren?
That's correct.
Yeah. So... you know, unfortunately, it's a big cost. It was $10,000. They're talking about $18,000 now and stuff. The other thing is, on second units, I would like to see a good look taken at those fees, because I do think they're important for affordable housing type situations. And you know, the house is already there; they don't have to pay for the land and so on and so forth. So that might be something that we take a look at least second units.
I thought I saw Planning Commissioner Colomarino.
Yes, I have a question for staff. It seems like the main catch-up that the city has to do and the challenge that lies ahead relates to the lower-cost housing. And we've been hearing about the fact that the fees and costs, building costs, are disproportionately high with respect to that type of housing. And I'm wondering whether there is now a program or whether there can be a program designed that would recognize certain units are going to fall into this category of lower cost housing. I'm not sure how you define that category exactly, but try to establish a program that says if you are going to fit in that category, we are going to try to remove some of the hoops that you have to jump through, reduce some of the fees. We're going to try to streamline this as much as possible and recognize that there is an element of disproportionality that inhibits people from building lower cost housing if we have these fees set up at the same level or in the same with the same parameters that we apply them to higher or more expensive housing.
One of the primary fees that's applied to a construction or residential project is the capital facility fee. And we do have a sliding scale. The higher the density of the project, the lower the capital facility fee is. So that has already been accommodated to a certain level, although, you know, it's open for the commission and council to review that further, although it has to be, there's state laws that regulate how your cap fees are set, and they have to actually be tied to actual impacts in the community. The biggest part of your capital facility fee is actually your road and traffic fee for the bridges and the freeway interchanges, and that is the majority of the fee that each unit pays is to offset the traffic. So to the degree that multifamily or higher density generates less trips, you could reduce the fee, and we've done that. You get in a problem justifying that maybe a lower income unit doesn't drive as much as, you know, a higher income unit, because that may not actually indeed be the case. So there's things like that that would have to be looked at, but I think we've looked at that to a certain degree. Also, just the cost of permits, the engineering, that sort of thing. As you build these larger multifamily projects, and I think that's what the state's pushing us toward with the larger 20-unit per acre projects, you do get a scale of efficiency there, where instead of designing individual single-family homes that all need their own engineering, their own plans, you build these larger multifamily units that can reuse the same plans over and over again. You start to spread those costs more broadly, and that helps with the affordability. And I think that's really what the state's pushing us to do, is to get the number of units stuff so that the land costs, the engineering costs, and all those other costs are spread more widely so that the individual unit cost comes down to a certain degree.
So then I guess that means to a certain extent there is such a program already, and it applies to just large high-density uses.
I think there is. That is part of our housing element currently, is to look at the fee structures, make sure there aren't barriers to affordable housing. I think, you know, I'm hearing from the commission and the public tonight that you want us to go back and take a look and, you know, make sure that there aren't any excessive fees for affordable units. I think that's something we can do and report back to at the at your future meetings in terms of some opportunities we might be able to find that we might be able to make some adjustments.
Thank you. Also, I just want to follow up with one other point, and that relates to the second units. It looks like there may be an opportunity there that's not being fully exploited right now to capture some of those units as part of the low-income units or affordable housing units. And I'm wondering whether there's some way to streamline the handling of those, that kind of construction.
Well, in terms of the process, the time, we have cut down all our plan check time frames. We've cut those in half. We are, at council's direction, trying to speed up that review process as much as possible. And just because the quantity of development activities dropped off, that has sped that up quite a bit at the same time. In terms of the second units, I think there's kind of two classifications. There's those new ones that come in, and I think those go fairly smoothly through the process. But there is a number of units that likely exist out there in the community that aren't permitted second units. We have in the past, as I mentioned, experimented with an amnesty program where owners of these guest houses and recreational bonus rooms could come in and get those permitted as formal recognized second units, and I think that is a program that we should probably re-explore and see if there is a way to encourage some of those non-permitted additional units to come through so that we could recognize and make sure they're permitted correctly, address all the health and safety issues, that sort of thing as well.
And on the new units, do you think, is there any way that it might be, you heard about the cost of building a second unit, is there any way that, what is your reaction to that? Is there anything that the city can do, you think, to deal with that problem?
I think that is something we'll look and make sure we understand what our variables are, but we don't control all of them. There's water company fees that are a big part of it. There's school district fees that are a part of it. There's just the cost of doing the engineering and the soils reports that are required by the building code. So we don't control all the variables, and then there's just the cost of construction and labor and all those sorts of things. But to the items that we control, I think that is something we'll take a look at, and we'll see if we can make some recommendations in terms of where adjustments might be warranted.
I believe it's Councilmember Kelly next, and
yes.
Then Councilmember Bennett.
Just regarding the process, I think with the support of the other council members, I've kind of been spearheading working with staff on speeding up the system and making it a little bit easier. And there's been some great advancements made in the last 5 to 6 months. And I think next Tuesday, Warren or you or Jim Lewis are going to give an update on where we're at on that process.
I'll be making that presentation.
Yeah, so we are working on it. You know, I wish you could say you could walk in the morning and get it done that afternoon, but it's just not quite that easy. There's a lot of things you have to approach. And then getting back to the affordable housing, having been a builder for years and what have you, I'm a little bit knowledgeable about this. The moderate income housing on a large project can pretty much be absorbed by the builder because he's going to get some density increases and what have you when he builds that project. So that works out pretty good. It's when you get into the low cost housing, if you look at the numbers up there and what the other gentleman said, you know, they're very easily going to have $200,000 or more into the unit. And then you look at what the rental rate can be and what the property taxes are. You wouldn't do this on an individual basis. I mean, it just doesn't make any sense whatsoever. But when you go into the single-family residences where people are building these, usually it's for a parent or a child or what have you, and it works real good until that's removed, and then it turns into a rental unit.
And obviously, they don't want to deed restrict it down to a low income because it's just not economically feasible to do it. So I think the low income housing is where we have to really concentrate our efforts on the fees and become a partner in the cost of trying to control these things and the process to get them through. I think at one time, as far as the single units, there was some talk about having some stock plans on file where somebody could come in and pick out plan A, B, or C, and it was really already plan checked, and you just get it stamped and it fit on your property and away you went. But that work is in process.
I think Planning Commissioner Benz?
Yes. I know of probably a dozen cities that already have existing programs that use low and moderate income funds from the Redevelopment Agency, grants, any available funding from federal government or state government to actually implement housing programs that you can get your building permit for low and moderate income housing. Home within a couple of days. Most of it is done by privatizing the operation, but I'm sure our consultant could also tell you that she probably knows 50 cities that have current working low and moderate income housing programs that this city could adopt very readily and wouldn't have to reinvent the wheel. And the streaming of permits is done throughout the whole state of California. There's all kinds of successful programs where it's occurring, and there's not any reason why the city can't just grab a hold of some of those and use those to achieve the goals that the city council wishes to achieve with low and moderate income housing. And then the Planning Commission can do its job of complying with those rules and regulations on the projects that come before us for approval. Thank you.
I believe it's Planning Commissioner Moreno followed by Planning Commissioner Ward.
Thank you. Ms. Wise, is it required for us to be certified, do we have to be at the 20 unit per acre density?
We do, unless we can prove that we can do it at a lower density, which is very difficult to do.
Okay. And in terms of the second unit, just from my understanding, does a second unit qualify for affordable housing only if it's deed restricted, or if, let's say, I have a second unit and my parents have come to live with me, is that, how does that get qualified as an affordable unit?
We can count second units towards the allocation or fair share allocation if, in our analysis, we can show that they can rent to certain income categories. So if just by market rate, they're not deed restricted, but they hit that target of a low income, which is, I think is about, I actually forgot off the top of my head, $1,000 or $1,200 a month.
You said 855 or was
the very low?
Very
is
low.
900 and then it popped
1400,
up.
1400,
right.
I think you said was
right.
The low. Okay.
So we can document that at the market rate they rent for approximately that then they can meet those thresholds that we can count them towards those income levels.
Okay. And just a comment, any streamlining that we do to the extent it could be done for, you know, all projects that it makes sense to and we're able to, I would certainly be in favor of that. I'm also favorable of accommodating, looking at the size of second units to accommodate the manufactured homes that we've been talking about. I'm definitely amenable to that, as well as the amnesty for, you know, possible existing second units. So just to put that out there.
Thank you. That would be Planning Commissioner Ward.
Yes. Most of my questions have been answered, but I have one comment. Our first speaker talked about his experience with the somewhat dismissive attitude of the Planning Commission some years ago, and I'll echo that. I sat in on several meetings, and I was just surprised at how several businessmen just got beat up unmercifully. But I think if you come to some Planning Commissions now, I'm not necessarily beating our drum, but our whole mission here is not to beat up on people, but to be, you know, very business friendly. And we're trying to get things done. And I think there's a whole different attitude on both the City Council and the Planning Commission. So I echo I echo what you said, and you know that's one of the reasons I'm sitting here, because you know I thought there was a need for some people that have some business background and some empathy of what businessmen went through when they put money at risk. And so I'm very proud of the policy that the staff is showing, and that both the City Council and the Planning Commission are showing to the business people that come before us.
Councilmember Clay?
Yes, and I would certainly agree with Chuck Ward, and I'm very happy with the attitude of the Planning Commission right down the line. I think it's really been refreshing. But I would like to give a little history. We didn't have second units up in 4 or 5 years ago, right? And there was a heck of a resistance just to get it through. We used to have a thing called guest houses, and people turned them into second units, and you know there was this big controversy, and it took a year and a half to even get to the point where we had second units. And I think it's been a great program. Unfortunately, the cost of the water meters and stuff is too bad. I think I would go for the larger second unit now. That was a big issue when we first discussed second units, and also the amnesty. I think it'd be good to open that up again. You know, you can say it's too much, but when you're out there selling your place and you're going to sell a non-conforming unit, and you're not going to get very much for it. If you have a second unit that is permitted and so on, it can be used. You cannot build a second unit for a rental. It just doesn't pencil out, but they are built for family members usually, and then they do turn into rentals occasionally, or caretaker units and so on and so forth. But the other thing is, on other cities, it's really, you know, if Mr. Bentz knows other cities, it's really easy just gets, you know, to get their information from them and have them bring it down. And when we were dealing with our affordable housing information, I got some information from other cities and give it to Wade and Warren, and turned it in that we had a pretty good program. So I would say get that information. It's basically a matter of contacting them, and usually they'll shoot it to you. So anyway, I think we're on the right track. We got a good council, we got a good commission, and we just go from there.
Planning Commissioner Schmidt.
Yes, and I was really happy to hear Councilman Kelly's comments about the stock plans, and I think those will go a long way. And once we can provide some constraints for someone to design within, they can put their own facade on it, whatever it looks like, but if it meets within that criteria, it's good. And then the other, I was just kind of laughing to myself. I mean, we're all stockholders in the water company, aren't we? So, I mean, couldn't we go down there and let them know what our point of view is on some of the issues as a stockholder? We each have three, right?
City Council Member Kelly.
Yes, I'd like to piggyback on Chuck Ward's comments. I think the current planning commission that we have is possibly one of the best ones that the city has ever had. And I sat on the planning commission for 7 years, and I observed some of the things that you are talking about. But I think with the new planning commission and the new city council, I think we've turned the leaf. I think almost every vote on the city, on the planning commission, has been 7-0. We're real close to it, and same with the city council on 5-0. So we are business friendly, and we do encourage people to come forward with their projects. I think you'll see a whole new Atascadero, and we would welcome your business.
Planning Commissioner Sturdivant.
Yeah, along with Dennis and Bob, what they were talking about, the plans, like the low-income plans, having plans that people can come in and get, I was thinking, you know, if there was a one-stop shop for low-income housing, in other words, the plans for the house, the permit fees, that it was a known, everything was a known, and you had a group of, you could maybe go out to investors, builders, have a group of people say, these are lots we have, here's packages we have, this is exactly what it's going to cost you, here's your profit margin. Anyway, you know, I'm not a builder, I don't do it, but I just thought that would be something that possibly could, I don't know how we would do it, but kind of that kind of an idea, just a one-stop shop kind of thing.
Okay, thank you. Councilmember Kelly?
Just as an example to show you how easy it used to be, you used to be able to go down to the county and you could pull out a sheet that was a foundation plan. You could pull out another sheet that showed you how to frame a house. Another one showed you how to put the electrical in it. You could staple it together, take a piece of paper, draw your lot out where the house was, walk over there and get a permit in 30 minutes and leave. We've come a long ways.
Well,
I wanted to put in a couple of items also. One of the things that I've heard people complain about is that people are required to put sprinklers in if their house expands over a certain size. I believe it's 3,000 square feet. And there are those who would like to build a granny unit that's connected to their home, and it would put them over that magic number, and it makes it cost much more expensive. So I wonder if perhaps we need to revisit that sprinklering policy. I'd like to bring it up for perhaps discussion among the joint session, the idea of mobile home parks or manufactured housing areas that we have several in town that are senior or restricted, some family. Some cities encourage them and others discourage them. We have one that's rather unusual. I haven't seen any place else. It's called Perkins is the subdivision, but all the streets have the name of a tree like ash or elm or whatever it may be. And the zoning is actually multifamily there, but the lots are individually owned and the homes are individually owned. So I wonder if there is any interest in at least putting forward a discussion on manufactured housing since it is considered very affordable. I'm seeing some nods, so perhaps that should come back again as well. One of the speakers in the public talked about idle construction that might need some kind of a boost or help from the city, whether it's purchased with redevelopment funds or some other means, which we have not even thought of, but perhaps the idle construction needs to come back to be thought about. There was some discussion about the Uniform Building Code versus the CBC and the structural analysis, and I don't know whether that's a possibility or that's completely off the table, but perhaps it could be considered. And I think perhaps a change of attitude, I'm not sure how to frame this, but we're hearing from the state that we need to be providing the affordable housing, and actually when someone builds this, they're providing a service because everybody will benefit from people that are not homeless. And so perhaps since this is a benefit, there needs to be some monetary way to assist them. And I've heard this repeatedly, but we haven't really put it into a unified theme that perhaps the capital facilities fees would be less or the building fees or the water meter would be subsidized. Whatever it may be, we want to put that on the table to consider this as a benefit and find some way to make it work. Any other comments before we close the meeting?
Yeah, just a comment or a question for Warren on the building code. You can't circumvent the building code, right? The state building code or the?
No, that's a minimum you have to comply with.
Period. And in regards to the fees that are, you know, been discussed and kind of pointing fingers at Atascadero, what was it, about 5 years ago we went through an extensive fee study and we come up with these fees based on making a nexus and so on and so forth. So do you remember that, Warren?
Yeah, that's how our capital facility fees are established. There's a process that's called, I think, AB 1600. It's a state law that specifies exactly how cities have to analyze and adopt their fees. We had a consultant that did all that work. We've updated them once. So that's how our fees are set. I'm not exactly sure how the water company fees are set, but I do know that a lot of the fee that everybody's worried about is funding the Nacimiento pipeline project.
Absolutely. And I just wanted to point out that, you know, at that time, the chamber went along with the fees. The majority of the builders went along and felt like it was fair. And so, you know, the fees are not just something that we pull out of the air, so to speak. And it was based on making a nexus and quite an extensive study.
Any other comments before the meeting is closed? Planning Commissioner Schmidt?
I just like to close and say when I was young, I would drive through Atascadero and say I never wanted to live here. Never, never, never. I've been living here now for 26 years, and I can say I won't leave. And one of the reasons why is Atascadero is a community of families, and that's its strength. And if we provide housing for other people and other families, there's a stability that comes with that. I mean, next door to where I live, there was a house that was for rent, and families moved in and out of it for a long time. They had young kids, and I always thought about, you know, there's a stability factor where the kid didn't know where his home was. I mean, they were constantly changing it. And if that's something that we need to consider, is that we need to provide more for our families. The more we provide more for our families, the more stable our community is going to be in the long run.
You are young, Dennis.
On that note, let's go ahead and adjourn at...
Go with the recommendation.
Do we need a recommendation, Warren? Do you have enough information?
I think we got enough information to move forward. So we're going to basically go back, sharpen our pencils, do some work, and we'll come back through the Planning Commission and the City Council as we prepare and put this draft together, and then the council will be the last stop before we submit it to the state.
Very good. Thank you. Meeting adjourned.